I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Alternative used to be a thing. Remember that? Alternative culture, alternative music, alternative news weeklies. Yes, I know, a bunch of them still exist. Fewer than before, dozens have gone under, a handful in Canada. Those that are left are struggling. They are arguably much less important than they once were. For a lot of people of a certain vintage, this was the first newspaper that actually was for you, that actually cared what young people were into. And for a lot of journalists, this was a way to get started. I moved to Montreal in the mid-90s to go to school, and I stuck around afterwards. There was the Montreal Hour and the Montreal Mirror. Both are now dead. Rupert Bottenberg was an editor at the Mirror for many years. Today, he is a visual artist, a member of the En Masse collective, enmasse.info. And you're going to hear me talk with him in a minute about alt weeklies. Actually, first we talked about music and comics, but then we spoke about alt weeklies, what they meant, and what happened. Wait for it.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They are not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible, heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
FreshBooks.com is the exclusive sponsor of Canada Land. You should use FreshBooks if you want to file invoices electronically, if you want to get paid electronically, if you want to get paid quicker, if you want to keep better track of your business. For all of this, check out FreshBooks.com. You were a music editor for how long?
I was the music editor at the Montreal Mirror for 13 years. Prior to that, I worked at the Mirror for about 2 years as a music freelancer, and that's what basically convinced them. But also, I was really good with deadlines. I was really fastidious and diligent, and that's kind of like what was needed in the position of an editor, because somebody has to have their shit together, so to speak.
Like in Montreal, like a city of slackers, you always struck me as a good, hard German. You know, Yes. You kind of had crack the whip. And
yeah, no, I am thankful in that respect for my upbringing. Sense. I mean, you know, I didn't grow up in a super like conservative or abusive household or anything, but it's just those little things that you kind of pick up on that like – you know, punctuality is just assumed to be – it's not an option. Like, you know, if you tell someone you're going to be somewhere at a certain time or have something in for a certain time, there's no reason why it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And if for whatever reason it doesn't show up, you kind of got to explain why. And just shrugging your shoulders and giggling, you know, doesn't really cut it, you know.
That must have been a source of constant tension with various music freelancers in your employ.
Yeah, it was interesting. I remember when I once remarking that what I needed for my little sort of area, my little cubicle area at the paper would have been like a whole variety of like, okay, I need a psychiatrist couch over here for some of the writers. I need one of those kind of like classic, you know, interrogation desks with a light in the face for some others. I needed sort of like a little pampered throne with some chocolates for others. You know, each of the different writers had their own kind of neuroses and so on and so forth. But, you know, they each had their strengths too.
Yeah.
Even the ones who couldn't necessarily write from a technical point of view all that well, you know, misspelled and had punctuation errors and so forth. I can do most of that cleanup, and there's copy editors and proofreaders. So that can be taken care of. What you can't really inject into anyone's writing is spirit and energy and engagement with the readership.
Yeah. I mean, you must have had a field day. I mean, you were the music editor of Montreal's Alternative Newsweekly in a period where Montreal's music scene is arguably the most interesting music scene of any city in the world.
Yeah, or at least at that point, you know, the hottest. You know, I still think Shibuya in Japan at the time was more interesting.
Okay.
Shibuya. But that was, you know.
It's a coin toss, Montreal or Shibuya. But,
you know. But no, it was – but what that meant also is that my phone was constantly ringing and I was constantly being harassed by writers from Europe and from the States. Like, you know, they saw me as a good starting point for, you know, a report on the
right.
Montreal scene at the time because, one, I was Anglo. Although the interesting thing was I always made a point – of saying, you know, by the way, in addition to Arcade Fire, Deers, Stars, Wolf Parade, all these basically bands that in part or in all were expats, people who weren't even from Montreal, who had come to Montreal to live there because of the very inexpensive rents and the healthy, vibrant art scene, I kind of pointed out, like, look, there's not only is there stuff going on and always has been stuff going on in other areas of music, like, look what Kid Koala is doing with hip hop, what Tiga is doing with electronic dance music. I always really, and this always got cut out of their articles, you have to talk about Jérôme Minière, you have to talk about Pierre Lapointe, like all this great francophone music that's going on in Montreal. And that's somehow always ended up on the cutting room floor.
Because you're born and raised Montreal.
Born in Nova Scotia. My parents were teaching out at Acadia University, but my dad got a job at Concordia before I was 2 years old. So I don't even remember Nova Scotia. So yes,
yeah.
I'm a Montrealer lifelong.
Yeah, and you're bilingual, and you more than anyone I knew in the little Anglo bubble had cultural ties to the Quebecois world there, both in music and in cartooning.
Well, comics in specific, I mean, you know, the music connection just sort of came naturally from the job. You know, it was the and I remember being very touched by that because at the very beginning when I took over as music editor, we were getting very little in the way of press releases or contact from the Francophone side of the music scene. They just assumed that the Mirror was precisely that, the Anglo bubble. And somehow word got out that Rupert Bottenberg took calls from French relationniste de presse, from publicists and from bands, and could respond well in French and actually cared and understood, as much as, you know, it was important to me whenever possible to put non-white people on the cover of the damn paper, in contrast to, you know, the more staid conservative, like the French language news weeklies, which got to a point where it was just every week it's like some white-haired, white-skinned, blue-eyed, French-speaking Quebecois on the cover of the paper. And that's not – I mean, that's Quebec, but that's not Montreal.
Yeah.
Montreal is a melting pot. It's cosmopolitan like the rest of – or much of the rest of Canada.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there's the bottom line that if you're doing garbage music, sorry, I'm not really going to make an effort. Maybe I'll get you a little listings photo just so you leave me alone, but
– but there's plenty of great music from the
– lots of great music. Yeah. Lots of really great music because – in no small part because the I mean, it's a little bit interesting because, you know, Quebec is Quebec. It's not France. They've got their own thing. They're much more rock-oriented.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, a lot of those musicians there were actually expats, transplants from France. France does not have – I mean, name one great French rock and roll band from France.
I cannot do
that. You can't.
Yeah.
You can't because there are none. There are some great new wave bands. Lots of great bands that kind of mix folk music with kind of rock energy. Ska had a big influence over there. But this is not a deficiency. This is to them, rock and roll was, they call it en couleur. Like it's just a color. It's a, like the way a painter will use different colors.
Right.
They will bring in elements of rock and roll, but it's not something that they're married to the way that North American Anglos are. Like this is – for an English-speaking North American, rock and roll was kind of, for the longest time, our baseline music.
Yeah.
So
everything kind of
grew out of
that.
Yeah, you use that as a base platform, whereas the French would use more like the chanson, the kind of jazz-flavored pop music, that sort of thing.
Right, where the like what Serge Gainsbourg came out of.
And yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
precisely.
It's a noble position to take. I could just hear the sound of you bashing your head against the wall repeatedly. I mean, the Anglo hipsters I knew in Montreal didn't seem to have much interest or access to the French speaking world, and you know.
No, but there was an improvement over the course of the time that I was there, and it's, you know, it was a two way street in the sense that it takes two to tango, and it took also an effort on the part of the Quebecois hipsters to kind of start connecting and plugging into what was going on with the Anglo scene.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you start having acts like Malajube who are like, you know, getting on Pitchfork and getting a little bit of buzz going on and things like that.
Yeah, so. And who are great. But I always felt like, I mean, the most exposure I got to it was through comics and that, you know, I think.
That's a whole different thing, yeah.
And that was sort of through you too. I mean, I knew about you before I met you. I knew about these comic jams in Montreal through a friend of mine. And that was my chief crossover point with Montreal.
To be honest, mine too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I had maybe a couple of Quebecois friends. I grew up in a very Anglo, in the enclave out in the West Island.
Yeah.
Where it was, you know, basically everyone I hung with was Anglo and had very little practice. I didn't really start speaking French well until I got a job downtown and sort of had no choice, you know, like minimum wage job kind of thing. But you got to speak French with the French customers.
Yeah.
The thing was, it was the comic jams as well. And I kind of took a leap of faith when I started doing the comic jams at really just to – this was the early 90s. I was working as a busboy at Purple Haze, a bar on St. Laurent Street. Back when the scene was all centered around that area on the plateau, it hadn't started to move up to Mile End and then Little Italy and then Park X. It was still concentrated in the plateau. So I was working in that area, and Sunday nights were always really dead because point of Purple Haze, its primary clientele was college kids. And Sunday night, they're back at their, you know, dorms or whatever, cramming their homework, getting ready for the student week. So Sundays were dead. And I said to my boss, look, I've kind of got this idea. Like me and my buddies, sometimes my Anglo comic buddies, will get together, make some coffee, smoke a bat, and just jam out comics together. Why don't we try something like that a little bit? Why don't we try to reach out to this? Because, you know, alternative comics were sort of on the rise, you know, Dan Klaus and Peter Bagg and that kind of thing. So I said, you know, let's give this a shot. And it didn't really last at Purple Haze because it wasn't a big – all the only people who showed up were cartoonists and they don't really spend money. But it established the comic jams. And from the very
Hold on a second. I gotta jump in here. Are you saying that you were the guy who started comic jams in Montreal, or are you suggesting that you started comic jams?
Well, I started comic jams in Montreal. I mean, there was no...
Had you known about this thing?
There was no other formal event. I mean, there was...
Had you heard of a comic jam before
no,
that?
No.
So you invented the comic jam.
I mean, it's quite possible that somebody, you know, elsewhere was doing something very similar.
I mean, the Zap guys used to get together.
Yeah. That was
like
my model. But... that's what I think what we were originally inspired by when I was hanging out with Bernie Moreau at his place. But at that point, it was an informal... We were just getting together at Buddy's house, making coffee, and like it was – we were just doing it for – we might make little zines of what we had produced. But no, as the comic jam, as a formal public structured event, that was, to the best of my knowledge, my creation. I certainly didn't invent the idea of comic artists jamming together.
No, but that's something like, you know, having a night at a bar where everybody gets together and does like, you know, Exquisite Corpses. I do one panel, pass it on to you, where we design. Yeah. I mean, that's something that I hadn't heard of until you did it. And it seems like it spread. I mean, I know that it's certainly
went it
quickly to Toronto. Mm-hmm. Where else have you been aware of it popping up?
Well, it started popping up various places like Boston, in New Brunswick, various places. You know, I didn't follow it too closely. I was just, you know, having fun doing my own thing and eventually sort of passed the torch to others to do it.
Yeah, I'm just quickly Googling here. I see there were comic jams in New York, Halifax, Vancouver, Chicago, Hawaii. I'm still around.
It still hangs around like it's... an ex of mine was she was using comic jams as one of the components of her PhD studies. And what I found out was that it still had a reputation. It still had – there was an awareness of it, particularly in the pedagogical environment.
Yeah.
I'd meet these young like university students, like young keeners in their early 20s, and they're like – you know, like, yes, I consider the comic jam a great modality. I'm, you know, working that into my studies and blah, blah, blah. And it's like I'd be – by the way, Rupert – invented those things and their jaws would just kind of hit the ground. So,
well, once you crack into the pedagogical postmodern academic world, you can write your own ticket after that.
But I'm talking about more about like working with kids in like primary school, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That it turned out that it's a great device. Like
it's a great collaborative way to get kids.
I know that I've done, you know, I've done workshops with teenagers in Montreal, but also up in Nunavik or Nunavut. I keep getting them mixed up. But up in Kangiksualjuak, which is a little village up in the, you know, the part, the northern part of Quebec, which is Inuit land. They're the best bunch of kids I ever worked with. But, you know, you show up in one of those classes with a room full of teenagers as the guy who's like, because of me, no math class. Instead, we're doing comics. You're gold, man. They love you.
Yeah.
They love you. Yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's a pretty interesting footnote to your career, which is, it seems like has gone in a bunch of interesting spots.
More of a preface because it sort of set the tone for a lot of things. Coming back to what we were talking about, the Francophones, with that very first one that I'd reached out to, I don't know how I, pre-internet, how did I even get their contact? I guess just bugging people like, do you have a number for so-and-so, for Cyrus, or Richard Suicide, Henriette Valium, all these kind of Quebecois cartoonists whose work being so rooted in both European bande dessinée and in American underground, Zap Comics, Robert Crumb and all that, the Quebecois really, because of their sort of cultural position as like the little pocket of Europe in North America, they were at that perfect meeting point of that stuff. So I loved what they were doing. And in my, you know, crappy French, I would call them up and leave messages on their answering machine. And they showed up. And it was initially kind of like awkward. People weren't really sure about talking to each other. But
yeah, they're cartoonists to begin with, so not the most social lot.
Yeah,
and then you got the two solitudes in the house.
Precisely. But the fact that we were all comic artists sort of negated the two solitudes.
Yeah.
In the sense that, well, we're all comic artists first and foremost.
You're not exaggerating. I mean, I knew some of these guys because of you. And then, you know, we were publishing a comic out of a university and we published some of them. And
I remember, yes.
You know, most of my exposure, like I say, to you know, getting French friends and hanging out was through comics and through kind of, I think, a bridge that you built.
Yeah.
And yet it felt very much like they could come our way. And French musicians became a part of the Anglo music scene, and French cartoonists became part of the Anglo comic scene, or it became a hybrid scene. Didn't go the other way, you know? I mean, Quebec media and art, I mean, it's a whole universe, and they really consume the hell out of their own stuff. But it doesn't matter how good your French is. If you're an Anglo, you can't really break into that.
Yeah, but I think that was more in us. That was I feel very strongly that I mean, keep in mind that much of the Anglo community of Montreal – the young artsy Anglo community is not Montrealers. They're people coming from Victoria, BC or Edmonton or whatever. So they have very little grasp of French.
Yeah.
And then they sort of plant themselves in the hipster, the Anglo hipster zone, which, you know, Mile End was the big area at the time of the Montreal music explosion. And they kind of like live in that little cloistered world, that little shut off world where they only deal with people who speak English and they don't really explore the city.
It's polite of you to say they and not you, Jesse, for the 10 years you were in Montreal. Because, yeah, I lived in the plateau in Mile End, and my world was English speaking.
I never saw you as part of that. I always saw you as kind of more like a free agent culturally, you know?
It's interesting. Like, it was such a small world, and yet it kind of encompassed so much. Mm-hmm. And the music scene that became this kind of storied Montreal music scene, at the time that I came there, it was kind of like on fumes of me, Mom, and Morgenthaler, and then like, and you were very attached to the Montreal ska scene, which kind of had this like crossover with comics, you know, like,
but no crossover with the hipsters.
No,
oh my God, they despise ska.
A little too earnest, I guess.
Well, also too much fun,
maybe
too much about like it's not enough about looking cool.
Yeah.
And you don't really mind acting like kind of like a goof and dressing kind of nerdy and all this, but
can't really see Godspeed You Black Emperor skanking at
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not so fond of puns, and ska really enjoyed the puns.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little too much for even for me. But, you know, a lot of the attraction, it's funny you mentioned the comics, because a lot of the attraction to me in ska, the larger, I mean, I just enjoy the music. I love old Jamaican rocksteady, Jamaican soul music, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's where the ska thing came from, as well as the British punk scene. It was kind of a fusion of those two. So musically, I really enjoyed it. But also the visual aesthetic of ska, which was so rooted in two-tone records, which was all about black and white, you know, and there was a political message there, black members and white members in the same band. Imagine that. But, you know, for someone who was coming from very kind of like a lo-fi, you know, production environment in terms of like, well, no, we can do photocopies. We can't do full color litho. We can do black and white photocopies.
Yeah, mini comics and zines and Scott, it all kind of worked together.
The show posters and all that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun, and that spirit of fun, like, it kind of had its moment, and then things got a little bit more self-serious and hipstery.
Yeah. Well, you know, the ska thing was just doing its own thing and attracting, and there was your real crossover.
Yeah.
You know, bands like the Planet Smashers, purely, entirely Anglo bands, the rest of Quebec just ate them up. Like, they were hugely popular, still are.
Are those guys still touring? Are they still?
They are.
Yeah.
I think they're coming to the 20th anniversary of Stomp Records.
Wow.
And they just keep at it. I mean, you know, they've got kids, they pursued their own careers, but they hold it together, you know? And so there was that was another thing with the ska scene. That's also, I think, where I connected with a lot of Quebecois.
Right.
Was in a scene that was like the Quebecois, because the Quebecois are on their own schedule.
Yeah.
Music-wise and culturally. In some respects, they're way ahead of the curve.
And just in terms of time and when they show up to things.
There is that, yeah. No, absolutely. Montreal style.
No, I mean, I hit there when I was 18, and I couldn't think of a better place to be at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
All this stuff kind of cross-pollinating. And kind of at the center of it was the Mirror, and I think to a lesser extent – The Hour.
To a lesser extent, yes, definitely. I mean, it should be mentioned that before even doing music writing for The Mirror, the music writing thing came along because I'd been doing a little bit of writing for Vice.
Yeah.
I actually helped deliver the first issue of Voice before they dropped the O and became Vice. So I was involved with that from the very beginning, and that sort of led me over to The Mirror. But as a writer, I came into The Mirror as music editor right at the transition point when Quebecor, the big you know, printing and publishing juggernaut in Quebec, bought the paper out. Alistair Sutherland, the editor-in-chief, and I kind of pow out at the beginning. And it's like that was the direction we wanted to take The Mirror as well, away from the kind of dull and, you know, not even terribly morally astute sort of PC leftism, the holier-than-thou, And we wanted to make a paper that was raunchier, funnier, cooler, and more interesting. And we took great pride that the very first cover story we did was Nashville Pussy, the band that was kind of blowing up at that point. And that sort of set the tone, and we went from there.
The heyday of the Mirror, you know, to compare it to the Hour, and I think that, you know, I admired writers at both, and I had connections to both and friends both. The Mirror felt like more of a mirror. It felt like it was more of a reflection of what it was like to live in that city.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hour was like what was on the alternative subsection of the mainstream media's promotional calendar that week.
Yeah.
If there was a movie being promoted, it would be on the cover of the Hour. Whereas the Mirror, I mean, almost to a fault, we had a joke that, like, if you live in Montreal long enough, you get to be on the cover of the Mirror. You know? And, like, you'd see, like, oh, yeah, my friend made a t-shirt. He's on the cover of the Mirror.
Yeah.
But it really kind of almost felt like a little community newspaper that reflected all these different strands of this, you know, weird cultural life in Montreal.
Yeah, I think we did a good job. I was very proud of that. And I had a good city to work with at that point.
Yeah. You know?
There was a lot going on.
The thing about being a cultural journalist for a paper like that is, like, as homey as it could kind of feel, and it was a small community of people, and, like, I know the Hour guys all drank at the Copa. I don't know. Where did you guys drink?
We drank initially at the McGill Pub, which was on McGill. But as over the course of the, you know, 15 years that I was working at the Mirror, Old Montreal started to get more populated, more condos, more businesses.
Yeah.
McGill Street got kind of gentrified. Our beloved sleazy old pub got transformed into some shishi resto bar for suits. So I moved over to we all moved over to Pub Victoria.
Yeah.
Basically, that was just Tuesday nights when we put the paper to bed. Okay, we're going out for drinks.
Right, right. And Montreal had a good, you know, the Saint Cassette tradition and just, you know, socializing with your colleagues. I mean, it felt like, I mean, just being kind of like vaguely connected to a bunch of people at both papers, if there was a band in town, if there was a writer doing a reading, if there was a festival, if a new movie was coming out, it all kind of flowed through the offices of these weeklies.
Yeah.
And as people graduated from Concordia and McGill and, like, outgrew their school newspapers, they'd start freelancing for one of these papers and they'd get comped to go to something. And, you get a free meal. You know, I had friends who were writing the food reviews. I remember you guys had Spanky Horowitz, like, doing the reviews of, like, hospital food and Bolarama hot dogs.
Well,
and
I also asked him about that. Like, you know, Spanky, you've got that huge, like, Star of David medallion. What are you doing shoving a hot dog in your face? And his answer was just, like, something along the lines of, well, we invented salt and refrigeration, so it's okay now. You know, like,
come on, how many Jews do you know in Montreal who keep kosher?
That's right. True.
It's sort of humbling looking back on it. You know, like, what we thought was important, who was on the cover, who wrote the cover, what the, you know, debate was about in the letters section or what opinion was expressed. All of this was secondary to what was actually driving the paper. Mm-hmm. The engine of the paper was really
advertising,
prostitute ads and music listings.
Yeah, it was the class ads specifically. Actually, more than anything, it was the she-males. Yeah,
really?
that was the big money maker, was the she-males.
Why?
Because I guess there's a lot of dudes who like a little bonus Frankfurter with their boobs and all that. You know, like, it seems.
That's amazing. Like, I thought I
had no idea that there would be such a huge market for that, but there you go.
I thought that was niche, but
no, it's bigger than you think.
Huh.
Apparently.
So it was shemale lust and things like that that would determine your page count and whether or not you could print stuff. That was the cash count.
It helped a lot, yeah. You know, like, movie ads, they started to sort of dwindle. I mean, all ads started to dwindle. And frankly, when Craigslist came along, I mean, what killed the newsweeklies, or is killing whatever's left of the newsweeklies? It's Facebook. It's Craigslist. It's all of this stuff.
Well, if you're aiming at 18 to 34-year-olds, you know, I mean, newspapers print in general is in the shape that it's in. But specifically, you know, that age group, the most fervent adopters of social media, and then, you couple that with, like, every kind of core thing that the Newsweekly provided, music listings, you know, hookups, sex listings, there's an app for that.
Yeah, precisely.
Like, it's funny because, like, everything that the weeklies were about for readers and for the writers was not what it was about as an economic model.
No. And I always understood that, like, you know, the backbone of the paper is the listings, film and music listings. The main reason people would pick these papers up was not to read stuff under my amazing byline. No, it was to read – not even to read, it's just to consult the listings, what shows are going on tonight.
And that's how they started. If I don't really have my history so straight, but you go back to, like, the Village Voice and the East Village Other, it was about, like, you know, a four page, like a big broadsheet that was just about where the band's playing, what's going on.
Yeah, what's going on? Here you go.
And then somebody realized that they could put an article here or there. And,
yeah,
and
that would fatten up the paper, and that could make more room for more ads. And before you knew it, the people selling futons were like, hey, let's put ads in there, and so on and so forth.
Seemed like you were having a lot of fun. You also did the comics issue, mm-hmm. you know, once a year. Mm-hmm. Like the alternative news weeklies in other cities, like here with Now, you know, in a lot of places, old hippies were running the show.
Yeah.
And it felt like an old man's newspaper. It still feels like mm-hmm. an old man's newspaper.
Yeah.
It certainly was the lunatics running the asylum at the Mirror. You know, you had sort of corporate overlords, but I didn't sense
they did. They did not give a damn about what we did, as long as the money was coming in, because our corporate overlords were all just doofus Quebecois, like coming into their SUVs from Laval, like, I mean, suburban dipshits to begin with, and worse yet, Quebecois suburban dipshits. So totally clueless. You know, if it's not Star Academy, they don't know what it is. So they just said, like, these Anglos seem to be doing something right, so we'll just leave them alone. And the only time they came poking around was when, you know, advertising revenue was dipping. And all they would suggest was like, hey, let's put a banner ad on the front, on the cover page. And we'd be like, that's stupid. And I think ultimately they drove the paper into the ground.
Yeah.
In part just by not so much active bad decisions as passive bad decisions or absence thereof.
Yeah.
That the things they needed to do, develop our website, you know, already in like 99, 2000, we were telling them like, look, put 50K, just pump 50K into the website, get somebody in here, let's update this thing. There's this whole new idea, social media. Maybe we could add an element of social media to the Mirror website. Imagine what would have happened if we'd done that. What could have happened?
Yeah.
You know, but they're like, nah, they're just cheap, and they don't want – nobody wants to stick their neck out so that upper management starts yelling at them. So.
Well, the same thing that made it so great probably doomed it, which is that like all around North America, they figured out a system that worked, certain kind of predictable advertising, and you know, was just going to come in. Nobody else really knew how to reach that demographic with anything in print.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had any vision in the business end of it. It was just like – put this thing out, and as long as it works, it works. But when it stopped working,
I mean, there's a lot to be said for if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But there's also something to be said for the world changes.
Yeah,
and you know, when you're looking down the, you know, you're looking down the highway, and you see the change coming.
You could have done something.
By 99, 2000, anyone who didn't see that change coming, the change being that media would go from being print to digital.
Yeah.
Anyone who didn't see that coming was basically unqualified for their job.
Well, some people are still living in denial of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, even with the death of all these papers and
Well, much of management culture, they just want their big paycheck and then they just put on their earmuffs and they don't know what's going on.
Do you regret it? Do you wish they had changed course and that still existed? I mean, it is like, I know that you kind of left, you saw the way things were, mm-hmm. the way the wind was blowing, and you went to pursue art and illustration and comics again.
Well, you know what? I would have, even if the Mirror was still roaring along, I would have left.
Yeah.
It was time for me to step away from what was basically like kind of a silver medal, you know, also ran kind of career of choice, which was journalism, and move back to what was really important to me, which was the visual arts.
You never really had your heart in it the way that, I mean, there are some people who edited it at Alternative News Weeklies who were like, this is a stepping stone for me in my journalism career, and I'm going to go work for a big glossy in the States, or I'm going to go be an editor at a daily
whatever
newspaper.
Whatever it may be. I mean, I think the people working for the Alternative News Weeklies wanted to stay somewhere in the alternative media realm.
I
think very few people coming to a paper like The Mirror were looking for jobs, you know, like this is just a stepping stone to, you know, the Gazette or something like that. They were, you know, it wouldn't be terribly obvious where they would go.
Yeah.
But
that's Montreal. Here you see kids, they have a byline in, you know, it used to be the Eye and now mm-hmm. it's the Grid. And then the next day they're at the CBC or they're at the Globe or something. But there, people kind of like carved out a little turf at a weekly and they could be there for a while.
And to be honest, like, you know, there wasn't really, you know, there isn't much in the way of CBC to go to. There is a CBC office in Montreal, and there are some people who got jobs there.
Small outpost. Dimitri from The Hour moved on to there.
Yeah.
Some people moved to the Gazette, but there's not a lot of Anglo media.
No, that's just it. So that, you know, your options are kind of limited.
Yeah.
But you know, I want to say this. Like, I would say my heart was in it, just because any task that I take on, you know, I don't really see much point in doing something unless you're going to do it fairly correctly. I mean, that goes back to the German thing.
Yeah.
You know? Like, if you're going to do something, do it right or just don't bother.
And yeah.
So, I mean, I really did, you know, with The Mirror, I really did put my back into it and, you know, did try to make the best music section I could and overall the best paper I could, because I was very involved in other aspects of it.
No, I wouldn't suggest otherwise. I think that you were very committed to what you were doing week to week, but I don't think you were terribly committed into where's this going to get me.
Yeah. No, I think I realized very early on that there was not really much in the way other than Alistair's desk. And Alistair, by his own admission, was like, they're going to get me out of here on a stretcher. I was just, I mean, it was all, the mirror was only ever supposed to be a placeholder job until, you know, my art career took off. But I kind of realized, especially now, it's very clear, it's clear as day, that the only way you're going to get an art career to take off is by throwing yourself into it entirely.
Yeah.
And that's what I did a couple of years ago, about 5 years ago. I mean, I still held on at the mirror, but I was really, I was just sleepwalking through it in the last couple of years. I did not care. And I just kind of like just running on fumes, running on like muscle memory, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, when I left the mirror, it was high time and it was just the right time for me to kind of really just sort of cut ties. Like I don't do journalism at all, you know?
Yeah. I feel like we should like pour out some liquor for the Alternative News Weekly. I mean, like it almost was like the precedent of the internet. Give it away for free. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things were started by college kids in their dorm rooms.
That's right.
On one piece of paper. Get out there, have a message people want to hear, build up an audience, make people care about it, find a way to make money off of it afterwards. And every one of these alternative news weeklies has a founding myth where there's three people sniping over whose it was and it got stolen from so-and-so.
Yeah, yeah.
And out of that, a couple decades of gainful employment for journalists and illustrators and photographers, careers were launched, writers, artists came out of that. Like it was really like an engine of cultural productivity, you know, in North
America.
That
established a lot of precedents and I think just put something in people's heads that something like this needs to be there.
Yeah. And the ones that are still left for the most part seem to have lost that spirit.
Yeah.
To a, you know, some degree or another, it doesn't feel as vibrant and they're just sort of like clinging to survival.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's I've taken us to sort of a depressing place to leave this.
Oh, well.
Okay, that's the show this week. I hope you liked it. You can email me with ideas for future shows at jesse@jessebrown.ca. I'm on Twitter @jessebrown. You might want to have a look at the additional content on our website at canadalandshow.com. I make this program with help from Tanara Yelland, and I'll have a new episode up on Monday. If you like Canada Land, recommend it. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.